on placidly chewing her cud. "It was the priest who said we should cleanse the place with fire, for it had the smell of evil about it, and no one kent the man. We couldn't tell, was it just a poor fellow as took his life by despair? Or was it murder?"
"I see."
Roger forced the words through the burn in his throat, and McLaren looked up suddenly at him. He saw the man's mouth drop open, his eyes bulging, and realized that in the warmth, he'd let the quilt slide back on his shoulders. McLaren was looking straight at his throat, where the livid and unmistakable scar of hanging must show plain in the dim red light. McLaren backed away, or tried to, but there was nowhere to go. He plastered himself against one beast's shaggy flank, making a low gobbling noise. The cow seemed annoyed by this, and brought her hoof down solidly on McLaren's foot. The consequent anguish and fury at least brought McLaren out of his fright, and when he had extricated himself, by means of thumps and curses, he turned bravely on Roger, jaw thrust out.
"Why come ye here, Ahaish?" he said, fists clenched, but his voice low. "Whatever sin I might have done, I did naught to you. I'd nae part in your death, and I said they must bury your body beneath the hearthstone before they fired the place. The priest wouldna have you in the kirkyard, aye?" he added,
evidently fearing that the ghost of the hanged man had come to complain about the unsanctified disposal of his mortal remains. Roger sighed and rubbed a hand over his face, the stubble rasping against his palm. He could see several curious faces, attracted by McLaren's cries, peering into the shadows of the byre from the glow of the room beyond.
"Have you got a rosary in the house, sir?" he said.
It was a long and restless night. Granny Wallace had snatched the children off Buck's bed as though fearing he might devour them the moment her back was turned, and put them to bed with her in the trundle, while the older children slept either with their parents or rolled up in quilts by the hearth. Roger shared the pariah's bed with Buck, for while his ability to hold the rosary in his hand, kiss the crucifix, and then lead the family in saying the rosary had, barely, kept Angus McLaren from throwing him out into the night and pissing on the gateposts to keep him from coming back in, it hadn't made him much more popular. He doubted Buck had slept much better than himself, for his ancestor had rolled out of bed at first light, declaring an urgent necessity to visit the privy. Roger had as hastily arisen, saying, "I'll help you," and pulled on a still damp shirt and breeks. He was pleased to see that Buck didn't actually appear to need help. He walked stiffly and limped a little, but his shoulders were square, and he wasn't gasping or turning blue.
"If they think you're a vengeful ghost, then what the devil do they think I am?" Buck inquired the instant they were clear of the cottage. "And surely to goodness you could have just said the Lord's Prayer once and not dragged everyone through 5 decades of the rosary and ruined the supper."
Buck had a point there, but Roger had been too much upset at the time to think of that. Besides, he'd wanted to give them time to recover from the shock.
"It wasn't ruined," he said crossly. "Only the neep's a bit scorched."
"Only?" Buck echoed.
"The place still reeks.
And the women hate you.
They'll put too much salt in your porridge, see if they don't. Where do you think we're going, us that way?"
He pointed at a path on the left that did indeed lead to the privy, this sitting in plain sight. Roger made another testy sound, but followed. He was off kilter this morning, distracted. No wonder about why, either.
"Now?"
he wondered, watching the door of the privy close behind Buck. It was a 2-seater, but he wasn't minded to broach what he had to say under conditions of that much intimacy, no matter how private the subject matter was.
"The healer,"
he said instead, through the door, choosing the simplest place to start.
"McEwen. He said he'd come back today to see to you."
"I don't need seeing to," Buck snapped. "I'm fine."
Roger had known the man long enough to recognize bravado covering fear, and replied accordingly.
"Aye, right. What did it feel like?" he asked curiously, when he put his hand on you.
Silence from the privy.
Did you feel anything?
He asked, after the silence had lengthened well past any time required for natural functions.
Maybe, said Buck's voice, gruff and reluctant. Maybe no. I fell asleep whilst he was tapping on my chest like a yaffle after tree grubs.
Why?
Did you understand what it was he said to you when he touched you?
Buck had been a lawyer in his own time. He must have studied Latin.
Did you?
A slight creak of wood and a rustling of cloth.
I did. I said it back to him just before he left.
I was asleep, Buck repeated doggedly.
Clearly he didn't want to talk about the healer, but he wasn't going to have a choice about that, Roger thought grimly.
Come out of there, will you? The McLarens are all out in the dooryard crossing their legs.
He glanced over his shoulder and was surprised to see that, in fact, the McLarens were out in the dooryard. Not all of them. It was only Angus and a tall boy, plainly a McLaren too from the shape of him. He seemed familiar. Had he been at the house the evening before? They were bent close together, talking in evident excitement, and the boy was pointing off toward the distant road.
Come out, Roger repeated, sudden urgency in his voice. Someone's coming. I hear horses.
The privy door flew open and Buck sprang out like a jack-in-the-box, stuffing his shirt into his breeks. His hair was matted and dirty, but his eyes were alert, and he looked entirely capable. That was reassuring. The horses had come up over the brow of the hill now. Six of them. Four of the shaggy Highland ponies called Garrans. One indifferent rangy bay, and a startlingly fine chestnut with a black mane. Buck seized Roger's arm with a grip like a horse's bite.
A year,
Buck said, half under his breath.
Who's that?
Chapter 40 Angels Unaware. Roger had no idea who the tall man with the good horse was, but it was crystal clear what he was, both from the deferential manner of the McLarens and from the way in which his companions fell naturally into place a step behind him. The man in charge.
A taxman of the Mackenzies, he wondered.
Most of the men wore a hunting tartan with a set in green, brown and white, but Roger wasn't yet familiar enough with the local patterns as to tell whether they came from somewhere close by or not. The tall man glanced over his shoulder at McLaren's nod, and his eyes rested on Roger and Buck with an air of casual interest. There was nothing threatening in his manner, but Roger felt himself draw up to his own full height, and wished for an instant that he wasn't barefoot and unshaven, breeks flapping unbuckled at his knees. At least he did have someone at his own back. Buck had fallen a step behind him. He hadn't time to be surprised at that before he came within the stranger's ken. The man was an inch or two shorter than himself, and close to his own age, dark and good-looking, in a faintly familiar sort of...
"Good morning to you, sir," the dark man said with a courteous inclination of the head. "My name is Dougal Mackenzie of Castle Leoch. And who might you be?"
"Dear Jesus bloody hell," he thought.
The shock rippled through him, and he hoped it didn't show on his face. He shook hands firmly.
"I'm Roger Jeremiah Mackenzie of Kyle of Lochosh," he said,
keeping his voice mild and, he hoped, assured, as some compensation for his shabby appearance. His voice sounded nearly normal this morning. If he didn't force it, with luck it wouldn't crack or gurgle.
"Your servant, sir,"
Mackenzie said, with a slight bow, surprising Roger with his elegant manners. He had deep-set hazel eyes which looked Roger over with frank interest, and a faint touch of what appeared to be amusement, before shifting to Buck.
"My kinsman," Roger said hastily, William Mackenzie."
When, he thought in agitation, was Buck born yet?
Would Dougal recognize the name William Buckley Mackenzie? But no, he can't be born yet. You can't exist twice in the same time. Can you? A question from Dougal Mackenzie interrupted this stream of confusion, though Roger missed hearing it. Buck answered, though.
My kinsman's son was taken,
he said, looking Dougal over with exactly, oh Jesus, exactly, the same attitude of insouciant confidence that the other Mackenzie carried.
About a week past. Abducted by a man named Cameron, Robert Cameron. Well, you maybe ken such a man. Dougal, of course, did not. Not surprising, as Cameron hadn't existed here until a week ago. But he conferred with his men, asked intelligent questions, and expressed an open sympathy and concern that at once comforted Roger and made him feel as though he was about to vomit. To this point, Dougal Mackenzie had been no more than a name on the historical page, momentarily, if vividly, illustrated by Claire's disjunct memories. Now he sat solid in the early morning sun beside Roger on the bench outside the McLaren's cottage, his plaid rough and smelling faintly of piss and heather, 2 days' stubble rasping as he scratched his jaw in thought. I like him, God help me. And God help me, I know what's going to happen to him. His eyes fixed in helpless fascination on the hollow of Dougal's throat, sun brown and strong, framed in the open collar of his crumpled shirt. Roger jerked his eyes away, glancing instead at the russet hairs on Dougal's wrist, these catching the sunlight as he motioned towards the east, talking of his brother, chieftain of the clan Mackenzie.
Colum doesn't travel himself, but he'll be glad to welcome the two of you, should you find yourself near Leoch in your search.
He smiled at Roger, who smiled back, warmed by it.
Where do you mean to go now?
Roger took a deep breath. Where indeed?
South, I think. William found no trace of Cameron in Inverness, so I'm thinking that he might be headed toward Edinburgh, meaning to take ship there.
Dougal pursed his lips, nodding in thought.
Well, then.
He turned to his men, who had sat down on the rocks that lined the path, and called to them.
Geordie, Thomas, we'll lend your beasts to these men. Get your bags. You'd have little chance of catching up to the villain on foot, he said, turning back to Roger. He must be mounted himself and moving fast, or you'd have found some trace of him.
Thank you,
Roger managed. He felt a deep chill in spite of the sun on his face.
I mean, that's very kind. We'll bring them back as soon as we can, or send them if we should be detained anywhere.
Moran tank, Buck murmured, nodding to Geordie and Thomas, who nodded back, looking dour but philosophical at the prospect of walking back to wherever they'd come from.
Where have they come from? Apparently Angus McLaren had sent his son off last night before supper to summon Dougal to come and have a look at his alarming guests. But Dougal and his men had to have been somewhere close at hand. The chink of metal as Jock dumped an obviously heavy bag on the ground beside Dougal gave him a clue. Quarter day. Dougal was collecting the rents for his brother, and likely on his way back to Leoch. A lot of the rents would have been paid in kind. Hams, chickens, wool, salt fish. Probably Dougal's party was accompanied by one or more wagons, which they'd left behind wherever they'd stayed last night. Angus McLaren and his oldest son stood a little to the side, eyes fixed suspiciously on Roger, as though he might sprout wings and fly away. Dougal turned to Angus with a smile and said in Gaelic,
"Don't trouble, friend. They're nae more goose than the lads and I are."
"Do not forget to entertain strangers," Buck said in the same language, "for thereby some have entertained angels unawares."
There was a startled pause at that, everyone staring at him. Then Dougal laughed and his men followed him. Angus merely made a polite noise in his throat, but shifted his weight and visibly relaxed. As though this had been a signal, and perhaps it was, the door opened,
and Mrs. McLaren and Ally came out with a stack of wooden bowls and a steaming pot of porridge. One of the smaller McLarens came after, carefully bearing a salt cellar in both hands. In the general hubbub of serving and eating, the women had oversalted his porridge, though not badly. Roger said quietly to Dougal, "Did McLaren actually send to have you come and see whether I was a ghost?" Dougal looked surprised, but then smiled, one side of his mouth turning up. It was the way Brianna smiled when she wanted to acknowledge a joke she didn't think was funny, or when she saw something funny that she didn't mean to share with the company. A searing pang followed the jolt of recognition, and Roger was obliged to look down for a moment and clear his throat in order to get control of his voice.
"No, man," Dougal said casually, also looking down, as he wiped his bowl with a bit of hard johnny cake taken from his saddlebag. "He thought I might be of help to you in your search."
He looked up then, straight at Roger's neck, and raised one dark, heavy brow.
"Not that the presence of a half-hanged man at your door doesn't raise questions, Ken."
"At least a half-hanged man can answer the questions," Buck put in. "Not like him from the croft above, eh?"
That startled Dougal, who put down his spoon and stared at Buck, who stared back, one fair brow raised.
"Holy Lord, do they see it? Either of them?"
It wasn't warm, despite the sun, but Roger felt sweat begin to trickle down his spine. It was more a matter of posture and expression than of feature, and yet the echo of similarity between the two faces was plain as the, well, as the long straight nose on both faces. Roger could see the thoughts flickering across Dougal's face. Surprise, curiosity, suspicion.
"And what have ye to do with him above?" he asked,
with a slight lift of his chin in the direction of the burnt-out croft.
"Not a thing so far as I can,"
Buck answered with a brief shrug.
"Only meaning is how if you want to know what happened to my kinsman, you can ask him. We've nothing to hide."
"Thanks a lot,"
Roger thought with a sideways look at his ancestor who smiled blandly back at him and resumed gingerly eating his salty porridge.
"Why the bloody hell did you say that, of all things?"
"I was hanged in mistake for another man,"
he said, as casually as possible, but he heard the voice grate in his throat, tightening, and had to stop to clear it.
"In America."
"America?"
Dougal repeated in open astonishment. All of them were staring at him now, men-at-arms and McLaren's both.
"What took you to America, and what brought you back, come to that?"
"My wife has kin there,"
Roger replied, wondering what the devil Buck was up to.
"In North Carolina, on the Cape Fear River."
He very nearly named Hector and Jocasta Cameron, before remembering that Jocasta was Dougal's sister. Also, that it was Culloden that had sent them to America. And Culloden hadn't happened yet.
"And he won't live to see it,"
he thought, watching Dougal's face as he spoke, feeling a state of bemused horror. Dougal would die, hours before the battle, in the attics of Culloden House near Inverness, with Jamie Fraser's dirk sunk in the hollow of his throat. He told the story of his hanging and rescue briefly, leaving out the context of the War of the Regulation, and leaving out Buck's role in getting him hanged, too. He could feel Buck there beside him, leaning forward, intent, but didn't look at him. Couldn't look at him without wanting to strangle him. Wanted to strangle him anyway. He could barely speak by the time he finished, and his heart was thumping in his ears with suppressed rage. Everyone was looking at him, with a range of emotions from awe to sympathy. Ally McLaren was openly sniffing, her apron hem at her nose, and even her mother looked as though she somewhat regretted the salt. Angus coughed and handed him a stone bottle of what turned out to be beer, and a very grateful beverage it was, too. He muttered thanks and gulped it, avoiding all eyes. Dougal nodded soberly, then turned to Angus.
"Tell me about the man above," he said. "When did that happen, and what you ken about it?"
McLaren's face lost a little of its natural high colour, and he looked as though he wanted his beer back.
6 days passed, Augusti.
He gave a brief and much less atmospheric account than he had the night before, but it was the same story. Dougal looked thoughtful, tapping his fingers gently on his knee.
"The woman," he said. "Do you ken where she's gone?" Heard as how she'd gone to Crane's Muir, sir."
McLaren's colour had all come back with interest, and he carefully avoided his wife's hard eye.
"Crane's Muir,"
Dougal repeated.
"Aye, well. Perhaps I'll seek her out then and just have a word. What's her name?" "Isbester,"
McLaren blurted.
"Gillis Isbester."
Roger didn't actually feel the earth shake under his feet, but was surprised that it hadn't.
"Isbester?"
Dougal's brows went up.
"From the Northern Isles, is she?"
McLaren shrugged in elaborate pantomime of ignorance and unconcern. He looked as though someone had made a serious attempt to boil his head, and Roger saw Dougal's mouth twitch again.
"Aye," he said dryly. "Well, an Orkney woman maybe won't be hard to find then in a place the size of Cranesmuir."
He lifted his chin in the direction of his men, and they all rose as one when he stood. So did Roger and Buck.
"Godspeed to you, gentlemen," he said, bowing to them. "I'll have word put about regarding your wee lad, if I hear anything. Where shall I send?"
Roger exchanged glances with Buck, nonplussed. He couldn't ask for word to be sent to Lallybroch, knowing what he knew of the relations between Brian Fraser and his brothers-in-law.
"Do you ken a place called Sheriff Muir?"
he asked, groping for some other place he knew that existed at the present time.
"There's a fine coaching in there, though not much else."
Dougal looked surprised, but nodded.
"I do, sir. I fought at Sheriff Muir with the Earl of Mar, and we supped there with him one night, my father and brother and I. Aye, I'll send word there if there is any. Thank you."
The words came half-choked, but clear enough. Dougal gave him a sympathetic nod, and then turned to take leave of the McLarens. Stopped by a sudden thought, though, he turned back.
"I dinna suppose you really are an angel, are you?"
he asked, quite seriously.
"No,"
Roger said, smiling as best he could, despite the coldness in his belly.
"And it isn't you that's talking to a ghost,"
he thought. He stood with Buck, watching the Mackenzies depart, Geordie and Thomas keeping up with little effort as the horses went slowly on the steep, rocky path. The phrase, "Blessed are those who have not seen but have believed," floated through his head. It was maybe not the believing that was the blessing. It was the not having to look. Seeing, sometimes, was bloody awful. Roger delayed their own departure as long as he decently could, hoping for the return of Dr. McEwen. But as the sun rose high in the sky, it was plain that the McLarens wanted them gone. And Buck wanted to go.
"I'm fine,"
he said crossly and thumped his chest with a fist.
"Sound as a drum."
Roger made a sceptical noise in his throat and was surprised. It hadn't hurt. He stopped himself putting a hand to his own throat. No need to draw attention to it, even if they were leaving.
"Aye. All right."
He turned to Angus McLaren and Stuart, who'd helpfully filled Roger's canteen in the hope of hurrying them on their way, and was standing with it dripping in his hands.
"I thank you for your hospitality, sir, and your kindness to my kinsman."
"Oh," said McLaren, a distinct look of relief coming over his face at what was plainly farewell.
"That's fine. Nae bother. If the healer should come along, would you thank him for us? and say I'll try to come and see him on our way back.
On your way back?
McLaren repeated with less enthusiasm.
Aye. We're bound into Lough Arbour to the Cameron lands. If we find Naitrice and my son there, though, we'll likely come back this way. Perhaps we'll call at Castle Leoch for news.
McLaren's face cleared at that.
Och aye, he said heartily. Good thought. Godspeed.
Chapter 41 In Which Things Converge.
No, it's not that I dinna want to be helping your mam, Mr. Buchan said for the third time, but I canna be having ructions going on in my house and criminals coming and going. Not with my girls there now, can I?
Jem shook his head obediently, though Mr. Buchan wasn't looking at him. He was peering into his rear-view mirror and looking over his shoulder now and then, like he thought somebody might be following them. It made Jem want to look too, but he couldn't see behind without getting up on his knees and turning round, and Mandy was passed out asleep, half on his lap. It was late, and he yawned, forgetting to cover his mouth. He thought of saying, excuse me, but he didn't think Mr. Buchan had noticed. He felt a burp coming, and did cover his mouth this time, tasting vinegar from the fish and chips. Mr. Buchan had brought an extra fish supper for Mam. It was in a brown paper bag on the floor by Jem's feet, so as not to get grease on the seat.
"Ken, when you does expect it back?"
Mr. Buchan asked abruptly, glancing down at him. Jem shook his head, feeling the fish and chips rise up in a queasy ball. Mr. Buchan's mouth pressed tight like he wanted to say something he thought he shouldn't.
"Daddy,"
Mandy murmured, then pushed her head into his ribs, snorted, and went back to sleep. He felt terrible. Mandy didn't even know where Dar was. She probably thought he was just at lodge or something. Mam said Dar would come back as soon as he figured out that Jem wasn't there with Granda. But how? He thought, and had to bite his lip hard not to cry.
How would he know?
It was dark, but there was a glow from the dashboard. If he cried, Mr. Buchan would maybe see. Headlights flashed in the rear-view mirror, and he looked up, brushing his sleeve furtively under his nose. He could see a white panel truck coming up behind them. Mr. Buchan said something under his breath and stepped on the gas pedal harder. Brianna had settled into the hunter's weight, a state of physical detachment and mental abeyance, mind and body each minding its own business, but able to spring into unified action the moment something worth eating showed up. Her mind was on the ridge, reliving a possum hunt with her cousin Ian, the pungent stickiness and eye-watering smoke of pine-knot torches, a glimpse of glowing eyes in a tree, and a sudden bristling possum like a nightmare in the branches, needle-toothed and gaping threats, hissing and growling like a flatulent motorboat. And then the phone rang. In an instant she was standing, gun in hand, every sense trained on the house. It came again, the short double, brrr, muffled by distance but unmistakable. It was the phone in Roger's study, and even as she thought this, she saw the brief glow of a light inside as the study door was opened, and the ringing phone abruptly stopped. Her scalp contracted, and she felt a brief kinship with the treed possum. But the possum hadn't had a shotgun. Her immediate impulse was to go and flush out whoever was in her house and demand to know the meaning of this. Her money was on Rob Cameron, and the thought of flushing him like a grouse and marching him out at the point of a gun made her hand tighten on said gun with anticipation. She had Jem back. Cameron would know she didn't need to keep him alive. But she hesitated in the door of the broch, looking down. But whoever was in the house had answered the phone. If I was a burglar, I wouldn't be answering the phone in the house I was burgling. Not unless I thought it would wake up the people inside. Whoever was in her house already knew no one was home.
Quod erat demonstrandum,
her father's voice said in her mind with a grim satisfaction. Someone in the house was expecting a call. She stepped outside with a deep breath of the fresh, cold scent of gorse replacing the dank musk of the broch, her heart beating fast and her mind working faster. Who would be calling him? Them. To say what? Maybe someone had been watching earlier, seen her coming down the forestry road. Maybe they were calling to tell Rob she was outside in the broch. No, that didn't make sense. Whoever was in the house, they'd been in there when she arrived. If someone had seen her come, they'd have called the house then. Ita sequitur, she murmured. Thus it follows. If the call wasn't about her, it must be either a warning that someone, the police, and why, was coming toward Lallybroch, or news that whoever was on the outside had found the kids. The metal of the barrel was slick under her sweating palm, and it took a noticeable effort to keep a firm grip on the gun. Even more of an effort not to run toward the house. Aggravating as it was, she had to wait. If someone had found the kids, she couldn't reach Fiona's house in time to protect them. She'd have to depend on Fiona and Ernie and the City of Inverness police. But if that was the case, whoever was in the house would surely be coming out right away. Unless that bastard Rob means to hang around in hopes of catching me unawares and... Despite the gun in her hand, that thought gave her an unpleasant squirm deep inside, one she recognised as the ghostly touch of Stephen Bonnet's penis. "I killed you, Stephen," she said under her breath, "and I'm glad you're dead. You may have company in hell pretty soon. Make sure the fire's lit for him, okay?" That restored her nerve, and dropping to her haunches, she duck-walked through the gorse, coming down the hillside at an angle that would bring her out near the kale yard, not by the path which was visible from the house. Even in the dark, she was taking no chances. There was a rising half-moon, though it showed erratically through scudding cloud. The sound of a car coming made her lift her head, peering over a tuft of dry broom. She put a hand in her pocket, thumbing through the loose shotgun shells. 14. That should be enough. Fiona's remark about ballistics flitted through her mind, along with a faint reminder of the possibility of going to prison for wholesale manslaughter. She might risk it for the satisfaction of killing Rob Cameron, but the unwelcome thought occurred to her that while she didn't need him to locate Jem anymore, she did need to find out what the hell was going on. And while the police might track down the man from the dam, if there was some sort of gang involved, Rob was likely the only way of finding out who the others were and what they wanted. The headlights jounced down the lane and into the dooryard, and she stood up abruptly. The motion-detecting light had come on, showing her Ernie's white panel truck, unmistakable, with Buchan Electrics / for all your current needs. Call 01463-775-4432 on the side with a drawing of a severed cable spitting sparks. "Bloody hell," she said. "Bloody, bloody hell!" The truck's door opened and Jem tumbled out, then turned round to help Mandy, who was no more than a short, dark blot in the recesses of the truck. "Get back in the truck!" Brianna bellowed, leaping down the slope, skittering on rolling stones and bending her ankles in spongy patches of heather. "Jemmy, get back!" She saw Jem's turn, his face white in the glare of the light, but it was too late. The front door flew open and two dark figures rushed out, running for the truck. She wasted no more breath but ran for all she was worth. A shotgun was useless at any distance. Or maybe not. She skidded to a halt, shouldered the gun, and fired. Buckshot flew into the gorse with a whizzing sound like tiny arrows, but the bang had halted the intruders in their tracks. "Back in the truck," she roared, and fired again. The intruders galloped toward the house, and Jem, bless his heart, leapt into the truck like a startled frog and slammed the door. Ernie, who had just got out, stood for a moment gawking up the slope, but then, realizing what had happened, came suddenly to life and dived for his own door. She reloaded in the glow of the spotlight. How long would the light stay on with no one moving in its range? She racked a fresh shell and ran for Ernie's truck. More headlights jerked her attention toward the lane. Holy Mary, Mother of God, who was this? Please, God, let it be the police. The light winked out, then on again almost at once as the second vehicle roared into the dooryard, moving fast. The people inside the house were hanging out of the drawing-room casement, yelling something at the new truck. Yes, it was another panel truck, much like Ernie's, save that it said Pulteney's, purveyor of fine game, and had a picture of a wild boar. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. She had to get to Ernie's truck before... too late. The fine game truck revved up and rammed Ernie's truck in the side, shunting it several yards. She could hear Mandy's scream above everything, sharp as an auger through her heart. Bloody Mother of Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ! She couldn't take time to circle the dooryard. She ran straight across it, took close aim, and shredded the front tire of the fine game truck with a blast of buckshot. "Stay in the truck!" she shouted, chambering the second shell and pointing the gun at the windshield in the same motion. A blur of white as at least two people ducked down out of sight below the dash. The men, yes, both men, inside the house were yelling at each other, and at the people in the truck, and at her. Useless adjurations and insults, mostly. But one of them was pointing out to the others that her weapon was a shotgun. Useless, except at short range. And only two shots.
"You can't cover us all, Hen."
That was Rob Cameron shouting from the Pulteney's truck. She didn't bother replying, but ran to get in range of the house. And the drawing-room window dissolved in a shower of glass. Sweat was running down her sides, tickling. She broke the gun and thumbed two more shells into place. She felt as though she were moving in slow motion, but the rest of the world was moving slower. With no sense of hurry, she walked to Ernie's truck and put her back against the door behind which Jem and Mandy were sheltering. A strong waft of fish and malt vinegar floated out as the window cranked down a few inches.
"Mum! Mummy! Mummy!"
"Bloody hell, Brianna, what's going on?"
"A bunch of nutters are trying to kill me and take my kids, Ernie," she said, raising her voice over Mandy's wailing. "What does it look like? How about you start the engine, hmm?" The other truck was out of effective shotgun range from here, and she could see only one side of it. She heard its door open on the other side and saw a flicker of movement inside the shattered window of the house. "Now would be a good time, Ernie." She wasn't forgetting that one of the bastards had her rifle. She could only hope they didn't know how to use it. Ernie was frantically turning the key and stomping the gas. She could hear him praying under his breath, but he'd flooded the engine. The starter whirred uselessly. Lower lip tucked under her teeth, she strode round the front of the truck in time to catch one of the people from the fine game truck. To her surprise, this one was a woman. A short, dumpy shape in a balaclava and an old barber. She raised the shotgun to her shoulder and the woman tried to run backward, tripped, and fell on her backside with an audible oof. She wanted to laugh, but then saw Cameron climbing out of the truck, her rifle in hand, and the urge left her.
"Drop it!"
She strode toward him, gun at her shoulder. He didn't know how to use the rifle. He glanced wildly from her to the gun as though hoping it would aim itself, then changed his mind and dropped it. The front door of the house slammed open and she heard running feet coming fast. She whirled on her heel and ran too, reaching Ernie's truck barely in time to hold off the two men from the house. One immediately began to sidle round, clearly meaning to circle the other truck and collect his idiot comrades. Rob Cameron was now advancing on her slowly, hands held up to show his non-offensive, ha, intent.
"Look, Brianna, we don't mean ye any harm," he said.
She racked a fresh shell in answer to that, and he took a step back.
"I mean it," he said, an edge to his voice. "We want to talk to you, is all."
"Aye, pull the other one," she said. "It's got bells on. Ernie,
Mam!
Don't you dare open that door until I say so, Jemmy.
Mam!
Get down on the floor, Jem, right now. Take Mandy. One of the men from the house and the dumpy woman were moving again. She could hear them. And the second man from the house had disappeared into the dark outside the circle of light. Ernie!
But, ma'am, somebody's coming.
Everyone froze for an instant, and the sound of an engine advancing down the farm track came clearly through the night. She turned and grabbed the door handle, jerking it open just as Ernie's engine finally coughed into full-throated life. She hurled herself into the seat, her feet narrowly missing Jem's head as he peered up from the footwell, eyes huge in the dim light.
"Let's go, Ernie," she said,
very calmly under the circumstance. "Kids, you stay down there." A rifle butt struck the window near Ernie's head, starring the glass, and he yelped, but didn't, God bless him, flood the engine again. Another blow, and the glass broke in a cascade of glittering fragments. Brianna dropped her own gun and lunged across Ernie, reaching for the rifle. She got a hand on it, but the man holding it wrenched it free. Grabbing wildly, she scrabbled at the balaclavaed shape, and the woolly helmet came off in her hand, leaving the man beneath open-mouthed with shock. The spotlight went off, plunging the yard into darkness, and bright spots danced in front of her eyes. It popped back on again as the new vehicle roared into the yard, horn blaring. Brianna lifted herself out of Ernie's lap, trying to see out through the windshield, then flung herself toward the other side of the truck. It was an ordinary car, a dark blue Fiat, looking like a toy as it circled the yard, horn blatting like a sow in heat.
"Friend, do you think?"
Ernie asked, his voice strained but not panicked.
"Or foe?"
"Friend," she said breathless, as the Fiat charged three of the intruders who were standing together, the unmasked rifle wielder, the woman in the barber jacket, and whoever the guy who wasn't Rob Cameron was. They scattered like cockroaches into the grass, and Ernie slammed a fist on the dash in exultation.
"That'll show the buggers."
Bree would have liked to stay and watch the rest of the show, but wherever Cameron was, he was undoubtedly too close.
"Go, Ernie!"
He went, with a terrible crunching and screeching of metal. The van lurched badly. The back axle must be damaged. She could only hope a wheel didn't come off. The blue Fiat was prowling the dooryard. It honked and flashed its lights at Ernie's truck, and a hand waved from the driver's window. Brianna stuck her head out cautiously and returned the wave, then dropped back into her seat, panting. Black spots were swimming in her field of vision, and her hair stuck to her face, lank with sweat. They limped down the lane in first gear, with a horrible grinding noise. From the sound of it, the back wheel well had caved in.
"Ma'am?"
Jemmy stuck his head up over the edge of the seat like a prairie dog.
"Can I come up now?"
"Sure."
She took a deep breath and helped Mandy scramble up after him. The little girl plastered herself at once to Brianna's chest, whimpering.
"It's okay, baby,"
she whispered into Mandy's hair, clinging to the solid small body as much as Mandy clung to her.
"Everything will be fine."
She glanced down at Jem, riding between Ernie and herself. He was hunched into himself and shivering visibly in his checked wool jacket, even though it was warm in the cab. She reached out a hand and took him by the back of the neck, shaking him gently.
"Okay there, pal?"
He nodded, but without saying anything. She folded her hand over his, clenched into a small fist on his knee, and held it tight, both in reassurance and to stop her own hand shaking. Ernie cleared his throat.
"I'm sorry, Brianna," he said gruffly. "I didn't ken that. I mean, I thought it would be okay to bring the bairns back, and after yon Cameron came to the house and hit Fiona, I..."
A trickle of sweat gleamed as it ran down behind his ear.
"He what?"
After the events of the last hour, this news registered only as a blip on her personal seismograph, obscured by the bigger shock waves that were only now dying down. But she asked questions, and Jem began to come out of his own shell shock, telling about his part, gradually becoming indignant about Mrs. Kelleher and the police dispatcher. She felt a quiver in the pit of her stomach that wasn't quite laughter, but close enough.
"Don't worry about it, Ernie."
She brushed off his renewed attempts at apology. Her voice rasped, her throat sore from shouting.
"I'd have done the same, I expect.
And we'd never have got away without you."
They'd never have been there without him in the first place, but he knew that as well as she did. No point in rubbing it in.
"Aye,
He drove in silence for a moment, then remarked conversationally, looking in the rear-view mirror,
"Yon wee blue motor's following us, Ken."
His throat moved as he swallowed. Brianna rubbed a hand over her face, then looked. Sure enough, the Fiat was trundling after them at a discreet distance. Ernie coughed.
Where do you want to go, Bri? Only I'm none so sure we'll make it all the way into the town. But there's a petrol station with a garage bay on the main road. If I was to stop there, they'd have a phone. You could call the police while I deal with the van.
Don't call the police, ma'am, Jemmy said, his nostrils flaring with disgust. They're no help.
She said noncommittally, and raised an eyebrow at Ernie, who nodded and set his jaw. She was inclined against calling the police herself, but out of concern lest they be too inquisitively helpful. She'd managed to deflect them from the touchy question of just where her husband was last night, telling them he was in London to visit the British Museum reading room, and that she'd call him as soon as they got home. If the police found out about the shootout at the OK Corral, there was going to be a lot more scrutiny of her private affairs. And it took no stretch of imagination at all to conclude that the police might really suspect her of having something to do with Roger's disappearance, since she couldn't produce him and couldn't tell them where he was. Might never be able to. She swallowed hard. The only recourse would be to claim that they'd had a fight and he'd walked out on her. But that would sound pretty flimsy in light of recent events. And she wouldn't say something like that in front of the kids, regardless. But stopping at the petrol station was the only thing she could see to do at the moment. If the blue Fiat followed them there, at least she might discover an ally. And if it was the police, incognito, well, she'd cross that bridge when she came to it. Adrenaline and shock had both left her now. She felt detached, dreamy, and very, very tired. Jamie's hand had relaxed in hers, but his fingers were still curled around her thumb. She leaned back, closing her eyes, and slowly traced the curve of Mandy's spine with her free hand. Her little girl had relaxed into sleep against her chest, her son with his head on her shoulder, the weight of her children's trust heavy on her heart. The petrol station was next to a little chef cafe. She left Ernie to talk to the garage man while she extracted the kids. She didn't bother looking over her shoulder. The blue Fiat had fallen back to a respectful distance, not crowding them as they crawled, clanking and grinding down the motorway at 20 miles an hour. If the driver didn't mean to talk to her, he'd have driven off and disappeared. Maybe she'd manage a cup of tea before she had to deal with him.
"Can't wait," she muttered. "Get the door, please, Jem."
Mandy was inert as a bag of cement in her arms, but began to stir at the smell of food. Bree gagged at the reek of stale frying oil, burnt chips, and synthetic pancake syrup, but ordered ice cream for Jem and Mandy, with a cup of tea for herself. Surely even this place couldn't ruin tea. A cup of barely warm water and a PG Tips tea bag convinced her otherwise. It didn't matter. Her throat was so tight that she doubted she could swallow even water. The blessed numbness of shock was lifting, much as she would have preferred to keep it wrapped blanket-like around her. The cafe seemed too bright, with acres of footmarked white lino. She felt exposed, like a bug on a grimy kitchen floor. Prickles of apprehension sparked unpleasantly over her scalp, and she kept her eyes fixed on the door, wishing she'd been able to bring the shotgun inside. She didn't realize that Jem had also been watching the door until he stiffened to attention beside her in the booth.
"Ma'am, it's Mr. Mengus."
For a moment, neither the words nor the sight of the man who'd just entered the cafe made any sense. She blinked several times, but he was still there, striding toward them with an anxious face. Jem's school principal.
"Mrs. Mackenzie," he said,
and reaching across the table, shook her hand fervently.
"Thank God you're all right."
Thanks, she said feebly. "You? Was that you? In the blue Fiat?"
It was like being keyed up to confront Darth Vader and coming face to face with Mickey Mouse. He actually blushed behind his glasses. He caught Jem's eye and smiled awkwardly.
"You're taking good care of your mother, then, Jem?"
"Aye, sir."
Jem was quite obviously about to burst with questions. Bree forestalled him with a quelling look and gestured to Lionel Mingus as to sit down. He did, and took a deep breath, about to say something, but was interrupted by the waitress, a solid, middle-aged woman with thick stockings and a cardigan, and an air that indicated that she didn't care whether they were space aliens or cockroaches, so long as they didn't complicate her life.
"Don't order the tea," Bree said with a nod toward her cup.
"Aye, thanks. I'll have a bacon butty and an iron brew," he asked tentatively, looking up at the waitress. "With tomato sauce."
She scorned to reply, but flipped her pad shut and trundled off.
"Right,"
Mingus said, squaring his shoulders like one about to face a firing squad.
"Tell me the one thing, would you? Was it Rob Cameron there at your house?"
"It was," Bree spoke tersely, recalling belatedly that Cameron was related to Mingus in some way. "A cousin or something?"
"Why?"
"He looked unhappy. A pale-faced man with slightly receding curly brown hair and glasses. He wasn't remarkable in any way, and yet usually had a presence, a friendliness and a quiet air of authority about him that drew the eye and made one feel reassured in his company. This was notably lacking tonight."
"I was afraid that it might be. I heard on the evening news that Rob was being looked for by the police."
He lowered his voice so there was no one within earshot.
"In connection with, well, with..."
He nodded discreetly toward Jem.
"Taking Jeremiah here."
"He did,"
Jem said, dropping his spoon and sitting up straight.
"He did, Mr. Mengus. He said he was going to take me to spend the night with Bobby. Only he didn't. He took me up to the rocks and..."
"Jem." Brianna spoke quietly, but it was her "shut up right now" voice. And he did, though with an audible snort and a glare at her.
"Yes, he did," she said levelly. "What do you know about it?"
He blinked in surprise.
Why, nothing. I can't imagine why he..."
He broke off, coughed, and taking his glasses off, pulled a pocket handkerchief out and polished them. By the time he put them back on, he pulled himself together.
"You may remember Rob Cameron's my cousin, and he's in lodge, of course. I was knocked off my perch to hear this about him, so I thought I'd maybe come out to Lallybroch, have a word with you and your husband."
He lifted an eyebrow, but she didn't respond to this obvious hint about Roger, and he went on,
"See that Jem was all right." "Are you all right, Jem?"
He broke off to ask seriously, glancing at the boy.
"Oh, aye. Fine,"
Jem replied airily, though he seemed tense.
"Sir,"
he added belatedly, and licked a smear of chocolate ice cream off his upper lip.
"That's good."
Mingus smiled at Jem, and Brianna saw a little of his usual warmth light up behind the glasses. The warmth was still in his eyes, though he was serious when he looked at her.
"I wanted to ask if there'd maybe been a mistake, but I'm thinking that there likely wasn't, in light of all that."
He tilted his head in the direction of Lallybroch and swallowed. Yes, there was, she said grimly, shifting Mandy's weight on her lap. And Rob Cameron made it. He grimaced, drew a deep breath, but nodded. I'd like to help, he said simply. You definitely did, she assured him, wondering what on earth to do with him now. Ick! Mandy, you're dribbling all over everywhere. Use a napkin, for heaven's sake. She swabbed Mandy's face briskly, ignoring her daughter's cranky whine. Could he help? She wanted badly to believe him. She was still shaking internally and all too ready to grab at any offer of assistance. But he was Rob Cameron's relative. And maybe he'd come out to the house to talk, and maybe he'd come for some other reason. He might, after all, have intervened to keep her from blasting Rob into bloody shreds, rather than to save her and the kids from Rob and his masked sidekicks.
I spoke to Ernie Buchan, Mingus said, nodding toward the plate glass window. He, seemed to think that you might not want the police involved.
No.
Bree's mouth was dry. She sipped the lukewarm tea, trying to think. It was getting harder by the moment. Her thoughts scattered like drops of quicksilver, wobbling away in a dozen directions.
Not just yet. We were at the police station half of last night. I really can't deal with any more questions tonight.
She took a deep breath and stared at him directly.
I don't know what's going on, she said. I don't know why Rob Cameron should have kidnapped Jemmy.
Yes, you do,
Jem started. And she whipped her head round and glared at him.
He glared back, red-eyed and clench-fisted, and with a jolt of alarm, she recognized the Fraser temper about to go off with a bang.
You do so know,
he said loudly enough that a couple of truckers at the counter turned round to look at him.
I told you. You wanted me to...
Mandy, who had started to drop off again, jerked awake and started to wail.
I want Daddy.
Jem's face was bright red with fury. At this it went white.
Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!
He shrieked at Mandy, who yelped in terror and screamed louder, trying to scramble up Brianna's body.
Daddy!
Jem. Lionel Mingus was on his feet, reaching for the boy, but Jem was absolutely beside himself, literally hopping up and down with rage. The entire restaurant was gaping at them.
Go away!
Jem roared at Mingus.
Damn it! Don't you touch me. Don't touch my mum.
And in an excess of passion, he kicked Mingus hard on the shin.
Jesus.
Jem. Bree had a grip on the struggling, bawling Mandy, but couldn't reach Jem before he picked up his dish of ice cream, flung it at the wall, and then ran out of the cafe, crashing the door open so hard that a man and woman on the verge of entering were forced to leap aside to avoid being knocked over as he rocketed past.
Brianna sat down quite suddenly, as all the blood left her head. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us.
The room was silent, save for Mandy's sobbing, though this was dying down as her panic subsided. She burrowed into Brianna's chest, burying her face in the padded coat.
Hush, sweetie, Bree whispered, bending her head so that Mandy's curls brushed her lips. Hush now. It's all right. Everything will be all right.
A muffled mumble ended with a tearful,
Daddy?
Yes, Bree said firmly. We'll see Daddy soon.
Lionel Mingus cleared his throat. He'd sat down to massage his shin, but left off doing this to gesture toward the door.
Had I better go after Jem?
No, he's all right. I mean, he's with Annie. I can see him.
They were in the parking lot, just visible in the glow of light from the neon sign. Jem had cannoned into Ernie, who was coming toward the restaurant, and was clinging to him like a limpet. As Brianna watched, Ernie, an experienced father, knelt down and hugged Jem to him, patting his back and smoothing his hair, talking earnestly to him.
Mm-hmm.
It was the waitress with Mingus's butty. A stolid face melted into sympathy.
The wee lass is tired, nae doot.
I'm sorry,
Bree said feebly, and nodded at the shattered dish and splotch of chocolate ice cream on the wall. I'll pay for it.
Och, dinna fash, lass, the waitress said, shaking her head. I've had weans. I can see you've got enough trouble to be going on with. Let me fetch you a nice cup of tea.
She trundled off. Without speaking, Lionel Mingus popped the tab on his can of iron brew and shoved it in her direction. She picked it up and gulped it. The advertising implied that the stuff was made from rusty iron girders salvaged from Glasgow shipyards. Only in Scotland would this have been considered a good selling point, she reflected. But it was about half sugar, and the glucose hit her bloodstream like the elixir of life. Mingus nodded, seeing her straighten up like a wilting flower revived.
"Where is Roger?" he asked softly.
"I don't know," she said, just as softly.
Mandy had given a final hiccuping sigh and fallen heavily asleep, face still buried in Brianna's coat. She twitched the quilted fabric aside so Mandy wouldn't suffocate.
"And I don't know when he's coming back."
He grimaced, looking unhappy and strangely embarrassed. He was having trouble meeting her eyes.
"I see. Mm-hmm. Was it... I mean, did he leave because of what Rob, did to Jim?"
His voice dropped even lower, and she blinked at him. Rising blood sugar had brought her thoughts back into focus, though, and suddenly the penny dropped and the blood rushed into her face. He thought Rob had abducted Jemmy in order to... And Jemmy had said, "You know what he did," and she'd shut him up sharp. And she'd said she didn't want the police involved.
Oh, dear Lord.
She took a deep breath and rubbed a hand over her face, wondering whether it was better to let him think Rob had molested Jemmy and was now trying to murder her in order to cover that up, or to tell him some halfway believable version of some part of the truth.
"Rob came to my house last night and tried to rape me," she said, leaning over Mandy's head in order to keep her voice low enough to escape the flapping ears of the truckers sitting at the counter, who were glancing covertly over their shoulders at her. "He'd already taken Jem, and Roger had left to try to find him. We thought he'd taken Jem away to Orkney."
That seems far enough, she thought.
"I left messages. I expect Roger will be back any time now, as soon as he hears that Jemmy's been found."
She crossed her fingers under the table. Mingus's face went blank, all his previous assumptions colliding with new ones.
He... Oh.
He paused for a moment, mechanically took a swallow of her cold tea and made a face.
"You mean," he said carefully, "that you think Rob took Jem in order to lure your husband away so that he, could..."
"Yes, I do."
She seized on this suggestion gratefully.
"But those other people with the..."
He passed a hand vaguely over his head, indicating the balaclavas.
"What on earth?"
"I have no idea," she said firmly.
She wasn't going to mention the Spanish gold unless or until she had to. The fewer people who knew about that, the better.
"And as for the other thing..."
But the mention of those other people reminded her of something, and she groped in her capacious pocket, drawing out the balaclava that she'd snatched off the man who'd broken the window with the rifle. She'd caught the barest glimpse of his face amidst the shifting light and shadow, and had no time to think about it. But now she did, and a fresh qualm went through her. "Do you know a man named Michael Callahan?" she asked.